wanted to share a little bit about you. And I thought breakups might be good because this is such a kind of a visceral topic that it might be something for you all to talk to each other a little bit. Sometimes I feel like I inadvertently get too much in the top-down kind of situation, which I don't mean to do. And plus, I've got a guest coming in, I hope, next time. Anyway, clinging. So the word clinging, for those of you who read the suttas, how many people read the suttas with any frequency here in this? Some? Any sutta readers? A little bit? How about there? A little bit? Yeah, okay, cool. Well, if you read, and when you read the suttas, if you read the suttas, the word clinging comes up a lot. Very important word. And it seems, in a sense, really mundane in English. I mean, clinging, really? That's it? You know, when I first started reading, I was almost disappointed when I was reading especially the Satipatthana Sutta, which is kind of the core sutta about practice, about this practice. And then, as I'll talk about in a minute, in the refrain, this word clinging was sort of the pinnacle word. And it seemed like, gosh, isn't that it, really? It seemed like something better, something more spiritual and cosmic. About transcendent understanding. But this is one of these things in the Dharma where we can't really see the significance of it, really. It's like a sort of the catch-22 of the Dharma until we awaken. Because clinging has a huge amount of meaning, just like dukkha. It's really hard to see what that really, really means until we wake up. So it's worth exploring to see what we can learn about it. And I've come to understand how, you know, partly just how natural the Dharma is, you know, how the Buddha he woke up, he discovered this incredible freedom, and then he tried to describe it to people. And that's what the Dharma teachings are. It's not like he sat down and came up with a system and then shared it. He just woke up and tried to explain. And as some of you know, as an aside, there's a funny story which one of the things that makes me believe that the suttas are actually pretty accurate, because there's a funny, who knows a funny story when the Buddha first went out to teach and he blew it the first time? Yeah. So he awakened to Bodhgaya, was walking to Gaya, which is about 20 kilometers away. And on the way, he meets this guy. And the guy was struck by the Buddha's radiance and said, well, who are you? How come you're so radiant? And the Buddha, this is the first, you know, sort of possible student. He decided to go teach because he had reservations. Like, nobody would understand. But he decided, with a lot of influence from celestial beings, to go teach. So this is the first person. And he says, who are you? And he says, well, I quite get this right, but basically I am the Tathagata, I am the awakened one. And the guy went, oh, okay, well, have a nice day. And he kind of did a sidestep and kept on walking. I was like, oh, that didn't work. So he had to, by the time he got to Bodhgaya, he had a different approach. But I always love that story because it's just so ridiculous. It must be true. But the point is that this stuff's hard to see. You know, it's hard to see because it's many ways, it's counterintuitive. In many ways, he's helping us go against our instincts that get us in trouble. And so we're unwrapping our way of our sort of default way of progressing much of the time. So that's why clinging is a word worth exploring to see what we can learn about what he meant and what the opposite, not clinging, might be about. And of course, there's a Pali word, because these English words are always like imperfect. And the Pali word is upadana. Upadana, that's the word for clinging. And it's got a verb form, upadiyati. But upadana is the one you'll hear a lot. So upadana. And one way of looking at clinging is that it's like craving, but with teeth or with claws or with permanence. Because craving, you know, we all experience that. We want stuff. We don't want stuff. We ricochet between what's pleasant and unpleasant. And that's a second noble truth. If we didn't have that constant reality, we'd be at peace. But as we go through life, we're jerked around by our cravings and pleasant and unpleasant and all of that. And tanha is a good word. That's the word, the Pali word for craving. It's best translated as thirst. And it's a good word because, you know, we have this kind of thirst for things. And for different people at different degrees, they're driven by their thirst. It makes them make all kinds of decisions, some of them good, some of them not so much. So thirst is something, tanha is something we all experience, unless we're awakened. And even then, I'm sure it comes up for even awakened beings, this longing or want or craving experience. We crave sense pleasures, we crave power, we crave an important sense of self, all kinds of stuff. But that's just an experience, tanha, which we can have, and what we do about it is kind of the critical matter. Because it's something that happens, like a noise through a window, like a hurting knee, craving happens. But then what do we do? Then what do we do? And so experiencing it but not acting on it is right, you know, you can say like 100 different things are at the core of the practice. But this one's at the core of the practice also. You know, how what we do with experiencing craving and how our mindfulness practice helps us navigate that. That's right at the core of what this journey is about. And, you know, all of us, when we experience some kind of craving, some kind of aversion, bring our practice to it, then we start to go deeper into it and maybe not react. Maybe we see how much of it's actually a physical sensation or a physical sensation tied to a story or a story of an anticipation of some pleasure we'll have, all these things. But we bring our practice to it just in the now, in this moment, having the experience of craving, don't do anything, just, oh, you again. And that's the end of the story. And that's actually, it's actually not clinging, it's a freedom. More about this later. But that is, you know, that is the edge where our practice works for all of us, moment by moment, in the midst of life, off the cushion life. So clinging, what's different about that? And it's, you can look at it as action with finality to it. We've gone beyond experiencing tanha, thirst, and we are doing something about it. We're taking a step of bonding or binding or grasping onto some sort of finality about that that then really defines who we are, what we do, where we go. It really becomes part of how we are at this time. So when we move into clinging, then it starts to define us. And then, you know, then we got problems unless we can find freedom out of it. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Clinging's a big deal. And when people, when anyone moves into, they make this transition into clinging, they have some kind of tanha, but they move into clinging, they've lost, in a sense, or obscured their potential. They've lost their flexibility to listen to other people because they've grasped onto something. They've lost their wisdom to see the great picture because they're fixated on something. They become just in a way when we identify with something that we're clinging to, we become that thing. And the word upadana also has a meaning of fuel in Pali, which suggests fire. And it has a sense of the kind of the burning, the fierce quality of this clinging. So it's this when we move into clinging, it really feeds the fire of suffering. And the intensity of this, the sort of voracious nature of fire, is behind the Buddha's third sermon. Some of you know the fire sermon? It's so interesting, because he did the first two in Sarnath, and then he went back to Bodh Gaya. Oh, actually, he went to Gaya, which is, as I said, 20 kilometers from Bodh Gaya. And the third sermon he gave to a group of fire-worshipping ascetics from Hindu tradition who were very dedicated to a fire-worshipping past, they, you know, the kind of folks that have ash all over them and all this extreme stuff. So he used metaphors that work with them. And in this fire sermon, he said, the eye is burning, forms are burning, burning with the fire of lust, the fire of hate, the fire of delusion, burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Yeah. Whole bunch of those heavy words. But that is talking about relating. He doesn't use the word upadana there in that sutta, but it's still in that same arena when we've crossed over into clean, something's really grabbed us. And I don't know about y'all, but you know, cast back in your memory, and something you really, really want. Has anyone really, really wanted something, got a little bit fixated about it? I'm raising my hand. You know, yeah, right? And think of what happens. It kind of becomes like obsessive, like a motorcycle. I remember that one. Or a position of power, or an attractive, intimate partner. And this clinging becomes like a fire in the belly. And in the process of this, we kind of lose. We lose our sense of self. We lose our sense of resting in flexibility. We become really fixated on this object, which the intimate partner thing is kind of, can be kind of hilarious because it has often nothing to do with that other person. It's our idea about it, our wanting, our grasping, or all these things. If they knew what was going on inside of us, they'd probably run away as fast as they could. So it's this kind of rigidity about it. And we sort of become something. We become, I am a motorcycle rider. Or we become, I am with this person, or I am a person of power. We see a lot of that going on in the world. You know, people want power and then they become this powerful person with the attached blindness, lack of mindfulness, compulsive behavior, all that stuff. So clinging is difficult. And think for those of us who have been around a close person in our family life, who has really been grasped by clinging in a certain way, and we've sort of lost a person and to some degree at some times. You know, for anyone who's had a person with addiction issues in a family and they've grasped onto that experience of the addictive substance, I mean, you kind of lose that person. They're not who they were. They're that polarity of getting the experience or not getting the experience becomes who they are, and it's pretty scary. And you can see the word clinging, boy, that applies. There's no question that applies there. There's something lost there. But we all are somewhere at varying times on that continuum. And that's suffering, right? That's dukkha, when we're not present, when something external to us is defining us. And we're grasping after that and doing things to get it and pushing people away in the process and creating often unethical choices in the process and hurting people around us who feel, you know, that that thing that is wanted was a priority over their needs. So it's just because of this power that it shows up in some real key places in the sutta. And some of you know, I try to read a little bit of suttas because it's helpful, and that's kind of how my head works. So it shows up in the 12 links of dependent origination, and it shows up in the descriptions of how we identify our sense of self with the skandhas or the khandhas. So some of you may know the 12 links. It's a little complicated. I'm still trying to get it completely in my heart. But nonetheless, they describe the multi-step way that we're caught in the cycle of samsara going around and around. But the core sequence, some of it's a little obscure, but the core sequence is there are six sense bases, then there's contact, you know, between the sense base and something. There's a feeling, it's pleasant or isn't, unpleasant or neutral. So if it's pleasant, let's say, we want it. Then there's craving, because of that want it, so we crave it. Then there's clinging, if we really go for it. And then that causes becoming, and that drives us in the cycle of birth and death. The clinging is so powerful because that's the optional one. That's the place where we can turn it. Craving happens. Clinging is where we can do something about it. And so that's in terms of the 12 links and in terms of our practice. This really helps us understand how that works and how our practice works, because that's a place where we don't have to be driven through future lifetimes to come back, you know, as a toad or whatever, in some unpleasant way. But it's just by exercising our mindfulness in the moment of craving, we don't do clinging, and then we don't keep going around. So it's number 9. And it's worth, you know, it's a way for any of you who try to figure out the 12 links. Some of it's a little obscure, especially in the beginning parts. But to dial in the role of clinging is really helpful because it helps us make it workable in a sense. So again, the key issue is what we do with the experience of tanha or thirst. If we yield to it and in the process cement ourselves into some action or identification, then we got a problem and then we suffer. We're walking ourselves right into dukkha. And then another key aspect of clinging, and the Buddha actually listed four, but the fourth one is clinging to a sense of self, believing that there is being sort of an unchanging, permanent self. And this lack of understanding of not self, of anatta, is something that the Buddha taught all the time. But when we think about it in terms of clinging, it becomes especially significant because it's not just sort of theoretical. It's what keeps us grasping. If we really think there's a concrete self, then, well, it kind of makes sense. If we feel craving, we want to go do it. I mean, that's, you know, want to make us self feel good. But the more we see through it, then it becomes, we actually understand that it's not going to be anything helpful. In the Upadana Sutta about this very thing, in the Connected Discourses, the Buddha said, "What bhikkhus are the five aggregates subject to clinging? They are form, aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the formations aggregate, and consciousness aggregate, all subject to clinging." So he's talking about the five aggregates, the five skandhas, the five khandhas. These are the list of things that make up our sense of self. But he's in every place, he's saying they're subject to clinging. So it kind of helps us get, so I'm sort of listing these two things. I won't go any further than these two. But it helps us get this whole sense of clinging in Upadana, how central it is to our journey on the path. And in particular, the aggregates are an issue only when we cling to them. I mean, they're parts of who we are, not a problem. When we cling to them, then it's a problem. And the nature of this clinging, you know, it can kind of be hard to see because we're conditioned in the world. We're trained to cling. You know, all the stuff, the advertisements are trying to get us to cling. What is that story? Anyway, you get it. You've all seen that. You're being trained to cling. All the Amazon trucks trying to get you to order things to be in them. It's pretty funny. But as we practice, it becomes clearer and clearer why that's not helpful. We don't want to do it. It's not taking us where we want to go. And, you know, we see how clinging to any of these five aspects of selfing, of the self, create all kinds of problems. They concretize. They make us be in problematic relationships. It makes it harder to get through the difficult stuff with the people close to us because we're stuck in one place or another, or we think they are, and we just can't see that those are parts floating. We cling to them. You know, what if someone... Have you had someone say something abrasive to you recently, perhaps? You know, or insulting? We probably all have, you know. And what do we do? I mean, maybe we feel hurt, you know, our anger arises, and maybe we retaliated. Or maybe we didn't. Because if we did, you know, then it probably has a difficulty, and it doesn't really help move through it. But if someone says something insulting and we can just recognize, oh, you can watch the button be pushed. You can watch the unpleasant happen. You can see what part of yourself is reacting. And then it can just blow by. It's not something we have to cling to. We can experience it, but not react. So it's really important, and it shows how important that mindfulness is when instances of self-identification flare up. And all those aspects in the pleasant and unpleasant and what we experience in our bodies, in the mental formations that come up, all those different of the five skandhas, they rise strongly because of, you know, because of the Vedanas, because of pleasant and unpleasant. But whether or not we cling there, that's the problem. And you can look at people we know, you know, that we all know people that they got hot buttons, and we know if we really accidentally say the wrong thing, they'll get really pissed off, and it's really hard to unwind it. And you can see how tightly they're clinging on to some identification of themselves. And if they could just see in the middle of it, just to be mindful in the middle of whatever they're experiencing, then it wouldn't be tight in the same way. So this clinging causes all kinds of problems. Okay, so to shift gears here, because we've been talking about the perils of clinging, now let's pivot and look into, from all this point of view, a better understanding, a sense of what not clinging is all about. Because that's the thing that when I, personally reading the suttas and I'm, you know, how do I say, hoping to be inspired on the path, and then this word not clinging comes up, and it was kind of like disappointing. I sort of wanted something hotter than not clinging. But actually, it's way deeper than that initial English suggests, and partly because of what we've just been exploring, how how tangled, how deep, how fiery is the clinging. So if we could not do that, how cool that would be, how important that would be. And one of the places many of us have seen the phrase not clinging is in the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta. Quite a few of you know what the Satipatthana Sutta is. It's number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's where the Buddha taught how to do mindfulness practice and also showed us how it worked. And just in thinking about this, I kind of realized, and kind of got a fresh take on how brilliant the structure of that is. Because there's this refrain that happens 13 times. And not clinging, the phrase is mentioned 13 times in the sutta. And that's kind of an unusual structure in the suttas. He doesn't like repeat things in quite that kind of way. But it's just because it's so important, they kind of get it into our reluctant little heads and hearts, I think, that he structured it that way. And in short, just to back up, the Satipatthana Sutta is about the four foundations of mindfulness and what he's basically describing the entire panorama of everything we could possibly experience and saying, be mindful of that. But he kind of walks us through everything we could possibly experience. And in every case, he's saying, be mindful of that, be mindful of that, be mindful of that, starting from the simplest, our body, and getting into subtler areas. Okay, thank you. See you next time. Mali, right? I think that was it. Wasn't that it? Was it Molly? Anyone remember? Yes, no, it's good. Yay. And the beauty of that is when, you know, we encounter anything, we bring mindfulness to it, and things we think are permanent, we can start to see they're impermanent. And things that we think are me, we start to see, well, there's no self there. And it can help us see how any kind of conditionality leads to dukkha. So we don't want to go there. So just bringing mindfulness to this vast panorama is just slowly, slowly, slowly kind of unpacks the mosaic of all the places that we cling. So there's a way in which mindfulness practice is kind of like, to be proven, but kind of like Teflon. You know, it's kind of a lubricant that steers us away from clinging. To be able to be aware of what's arising, then we don't stick there. Sorry if that's hackneyed, but I couldn't resist. Because you realize there's nothing to cling to, and there's just really no upside. And so he says this, like I said, 13 times. He brings up not clinging. And I think this is really skillful. I'll just read one of them on the body. He says, mindfulness that there is a body is established in her to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And she abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So that's the formula. And it's just that one last sentence. She abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So in one way it sounds okay, but actually, That's pretty cool. She abides independent, not clinging. So notice the power of that. Like, she abides independent is a statement of actualization of freedom. Because we're not being dragged around by stuff. You know, we're self-actualized in a way. We can do what we want if we're independent. We're not being grasped by the things we encounter. and then not clinging to anything in the world is kind of extraordinary when you think about it, because that's what a Buddha is. Fully awakened being, there's no place. They don't got any hot buttons left. So there's no place where they're stuck. And, just as I was kind of saying at the beginning, the check-in, it really struck me how everybody in this wonderful sangha is on the path, and it's changing who you are. There was a lot of peace, and just in this moment, and people feeling kind of at ease, kind of some kind of peacefulness, some kind of not clinging, some kind of freedom. And probably compared to some of your friends and colleagues, you have far fewer things that would have you cling than many people. So the practice has changed you. But here in the refrain, he's basically going through every single aspect of phenomena that we could encounter and saying to us that as we practice, as we establish bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness, we will be not clinging to anything in the world. And what might that, I'm almost done, what might that be like to not cling to anything in the world? And the Buddha, he gives some hints in the suttas. You kind of read between the lines and look at how he lives, what he does. And he links not clinging directly to the goal of nibbana, of awakening. And, nibbana describes it sometimes as happiness, talks about happiness quite a bit, as cooling. There's like a, as opposed to the fire, if you talk about the fire sutta on the other side, just a cooling of reaction, just being present, freedom from being stuck. This is sort of simplicity, but easy to say, hard to do. In the Upadana Sutta, in the connected discourses, he says, where there is no clinging, there is no becoming. Where there is no becoming, there is no birth. Where there is no birth, there is no aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. That is how this entire mass of suffering comes to an end. And then in the Anapanasati Sutta, and in 118, he says another way. He says, when he trains like this, I will breathe in letting go. He trains like this, I will breathe out letting go. A mendicant whose mind is well freed like this does not cling to anything in the world. Not clinging, he is not agitated. Not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. So, as is the case in many areas of the suttas, this is a doorway to nibbana. The great thing, there's so many doorways. But this is one of those doorways, and he's pointing to it right there. Mind is well free, does not cling to anything in the world. Not agitated, attains nibbana. So even though thus, you could say this not clinging, it's huge. It's huge. That funny little word, it seems kind of like, what's that about? It's really enormous. And it actually is pointing, taking us right to awakening itself, pointing at the ultimate goal of, you could say, the journey of life. And so, just by kind of working with that, we can better understand what we're doing on the path and how mindfulness practice leads us to freedom. Because we walk surrounded by tanha, Vedana's first, tanha second, and to varying degrees, we do or do not cling. But the more we can see through it and be really aware of what the mileposts are and what the peril is, we can also find the freedom. Just little bits, this little breakthrough, that little breakthrough. That's how it works over lifetimes. And it's funny, living in a wealthy world here in the Northwest in the Puget Sound area, it's kind of like I sometimes really struck when I see people, driving Lamborghinis and Ferraris and having giant yachts that cost God knows how many millions down there on the waterfront. Or Carillon Point is sort of like this funny fantasy of, wealth. And we could be tricked and, sort of go, oh, that'd be nice. Kind of pulled into it a little bit, feel a little part of us that wants something like that. I have my impulses once in a while. Not that I have any intention of doing anything about it, but I can see myself. But then at the end of the day, there's nothing there. At the end of the day, it's just empty. And you look how much trouble some of those people have navigating their lives anyway. It's just empty hand when they die. So if that's the case, if someone acts out clinging, you could say it was all for naught. The life. If they found some kindness, generated some kindness to others in the middle of it, that's good. And sometimes it's useful to try to imagine, to try to think of who the Buddha was and how he navigated during the 40 years he was teaching when he was walking in the Ganges Valley, up and down 300 miles between Srivasti on one end and Vulture Peak on the other. I mean, we don't know, but there's these glimpses, and you can start to, when you just sort of watch the suttis, you start to realize that he wasn't clinging to anything. There's nothing, the Buddha has no agendas. There's no hint of anything that he wants to get done, that he wants to experience, that he wants to grasp to himself. It's just this goodwill in kind of a gruff way. He's not kind of smiling and all friendly all the time. He can push people, but there's just this goodwill and it's not stickiness. It's really amazing. This vastness of seeing happens. So you might, we can think about that, the wisdom of not clinging. And that brings us, if we're not sticking anywhere, it brings us to really knowing the empty nature of all phenomena. And there's a way in which it brings us to, there's no bounds, there's no definitions, there's no limitation, because there's this vastness to it. So the Buddha walked in the world, and he did stuff. He did stuff in the world, and he had his personality, and he walked with love in the world, but he didn't cling, and he also didn't suffer. So we can be like that too.